Great greetings. Welcome. We're having a few technical difficulties today, but we seem to be going on. My computer is on life support today, so I managed to get my hard drive pulled out of my old computer and stuck into this new one. And I'm discovering, among other things, that the volume control is a real sketchy thing. It's kind of off or on. It's either full blast or it's just not there at all. So anyway, I hope things are coming through on your end all right.
Yeah.
Good. What's new? What's going on?
Well, we're going to be talking about Moana and about the Junior Knows Best phenomenon in animated films.
Okay, I don't know anything about the Junior Knows Best. Okay, yes, I do. Yes. All right, I thought they were thinking of a title of a film or something, but cool.
And yeah, we're gonna be talking about Spirited Away.
Always a great film. Anything by Miyazaki is always great. So that makes me happy. So yeah, I've been curious about Moana. How is it?
It's not bad. Okay. It's, you know, 98% fresh at Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay.
Only three critics did not come up with a fresh rating for it. I am one of the three.
So,
but when I posted my review, I was one of only two. Which
really?
Means some brave soul went ahead of me, and I followed, and someone else followed us, and that's it.
Okay. So
that's it.
All right, so you suck, and everyone hates you now.
They do. They absolutely do. Oh, really? Wait, it's down to 97% now. There are now five rotten reviews.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. So is there like a mob with torches and pitchforks outside your house now?
They used to do that, but they don't do that anymore.
Okay, it's like that Far Side cartoon of the guy at the Didn't Like Dances with Wolves.
Yes, that's right. You know? it's exactly like that, actually.
So what's it like to be perhaps the most hated critic in America today?
I'm pretty sure that I know who that title actually belongs to, and it's not me.
Well, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it belongs to another critic that I don't I don't talk about him.
Okay. So wait a minute, this is like a Fight Club thing, right? I mean, we do not talk about most hated critic in America, or
something like that. Yes.
Okay. That's all right.
The number one rule.
Okay. Is this somebody I should know? Have I heard of this guy?
Oh, come on, man.
I don't know.
He's a guy who used to belong to the New York Film Critics Circle, and he has a very interesting niche in the world of intersectional identity markers. He's a Christian, he's gay, he's a black man, he's extremely provocative. Oh, he's politically conservative in the grand scheme of things. Oh. Very provocative, said some very nasty and really inexcusable things. And he's one of these people who never apologizes and never backs down. So,
oh, well, see, this is where it really pays off to live in Seattle and not be in the whole East Coast film critics circle of things, because I still don't know who you're talking about.
Right.
So well, let's
stop talking about him.
Okay, we'll not talk about him. Okay. So, Moana.
Yes. Yes, Moana. The movie which I was only one of only five critics now. Five okay. critics who was bumptious enough not to give it the bright red tomato. And okay. You know, I don't hate it. I gave it a C+, which is the same rating that I gave Frozen, that other movie that I hated that I didn't really hate. But when everybody is loving on something and you're the voice saying, you know, there's problems here, you're the hater. So I'm the hater.
Okay.
Moana has a lot of things going for it. There's a lot of things that I like about it. It is set in a part of the world where Disney has never done an animated film before in the South Pacific, among a tribe of Polynesian indigenous Polynesian natives, and the heroine Moana is the daughter of the chief. And as far as animated heroines go, she's got a pretty good home life, and everything is, it's a very, very nice scenes early, right in the beginning of the film.
So she doesn't have a father who's mean or dead or absent?
He's not mean or dead or absent, but in one important way, his relationship with Moana is like the fathers who are mean or dead or absent.
You mean like all other Disney fathers?
Right, exactly. It's interesting because this trope that I've been writing about and noodling for, explicitly by name for 6 or 7 years now, mm-hmm. Since How to Train Your Dragon came out, it's the trope is called, or I call it, Junior Knows Best.
Okay.
And by that, I don't just mean the typical, like, smart kid, dumb adult thing that's been a staple of entertainment for at least as long as, you know, you can go back and watch silent movies that are like that. And I'm sure you could find it in vaudeville and probably in Shakespeare. I haven't really thought about it to that extent. Some uh-huh. people have said, well, you know, Romeo and Juliet, you know, it's not really the same thing, is it?
Mm-hmm.
But,
Well, Hamlet has an abusive and a dead. So,
but what you have going on in a lot of these films, and I think it really stands out if you look at, say, How to Train Your Dragon and Beauty and the Beast. You've got these three young protagonists with these three fathers, and the young protagonist has some kind of concern or dream or vision. Hiccup really wants to understand dragons rather than just mindlessly kill them. And Ariel is drawn to the surface world. She has all of these things, but she wants more.
Uh-huh.
and Moana loves her island and she loves her people, but she feels drawn to the open ocean. And the fathers in all these stories don't just say, you know, Moana, no going out of the ocean. Ariel, stay away from the surface world. Hiccup, kill that dragon. These are the social norms of their societies. Nobody is allowed to sail past the reef in Moana. Mm-hmm. All Viking warriors are expected to kill a dragon. It's a rite of passage. All merfolk are forbidden from having contact with the humans on the surface. And yet, all three of our protagonists defy these rules. They defy the norms of their society. And here's the key. In the end of the story, the protagonist's defiant ambitions are vindicated. And the father recognizes it. The father realizes that he was wrong, or at least that he would be wrong to stand in the way of his child. And this leads to a revolutionary breakthrough in the social status quo. Suddenly, we're not a tribe of dragon killers anymore. We're a tribe of dragon riders. Suddenly, all of the merfolk are fraternizing with Ariel's, or fraternizing with the humans at Ariel's wedding. Suddenly, Moana's people, this is a spoiler, you really don't want to know, you can turn off your radio for 10 seconds. Moana's people give up their sedentary ways on the island and they become seafarers again, which is what they were centuries and centuries earlier. So, mm-hmm. So it's this theme of not so much smart kids, dumb parents, but kids are smarter or know better than their parents, and rules and traditions exist to be broken.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting, of course, I mean, as you say that, because in a certain way, that's also a repetition of the gospel narrative. I'm sorry?
Say more about that.
Well, what's the big conflict that's going on? Jesus has a conflict with the elders of Israel. The conflict centers around, among other things, the law was made for man, not man for the law. you know, the elders of Israel come to Jesus repeatedly and say, that's against the rules. Healing people on the Sabbath is against the rules. And that dynamic does go on in the Gospels. Now, there's a lot more complexity to that. But it is a theme that you run into constantly in the Gospels. Is, you know, after all, the apostles are the young upstarts. So anyway, it's worth noting.
And all of that, you know, and people have said this to me, okay, Moana was chosen by divinity because the ocean is a divine reality and the ocean literally chooses Moana and it's a character in the story and it's, you know, it's the right. anthropomorphic ocean and, right. and okay. Yeah. If you are that person who's actually chosen by God, like Jesus was right. chosen by God.
Right.
Know, if Jesus wants to come along and tell the elders that they're wrong and he has a message from God that things are going to be different, that's one thing. When it's every animated protagonist, when it's Remy the rat in Ratatouille saying to his dad, his dad says to him, humans and rats can never get along now. Right. Give up on this silly cooking and come back to the colony. And Remy says, no, Dad, I won't. And in the end, Dad marshals the whole colony to go into the kitchen and cook for Remy.
Right.
It leads to revolutionary social breakthrough.
Right. Exactly.
And again, I'm not saying the trope is bad. I want to be right. clear about that. I'm not saying Junior Knows Best is bad and it's subversive and we shouldn't watch these movies because they're undermining the patriarchy. Although that is what they're doing. Right. But my point is what does concern me, and this is a concern, this is a critique, is mm-hmm. that this pattern is so ubiquitous
right.
that it, and what concerns me about the stories that my children watch is not one story, it's 100 stories. It's the right. unexamined patterns that tell children this is what the world is like.
Right.
That's
exactly
what concerns me about this.
And of course, you know what goes with that is it's. Well, we'll continue this when we get back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back with Deacon Stephen Gradonis talking about Moana and the Junior Knows Best trope right after this. Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We're talking about Moana, and which is not a controlled narcotic. Moana is a movie, actually. And that was a stupid joke. Sorry. And we're also talking about an article that Steve wrote for the National Catholic Register this week on the junior knows best phenomenon. Another thing that is just something I've noticed in the past is that you're right. This is just, it is ubiquitous all the time. I mean, you know, Ward Cleaver is really, really dead. in Leave It to Beaver, I mean, it was the kid that got himself into a jam, and then his wise father, you know, did wise fatherly things, and that was kind of the standard when I was a little kid. But this trope of, you know, the elders are either, and it's always the father,
usually.
Yeah, not always, but usually it's the father who is mean or dead or absent.
The mothers are very often absent. In fact, in the Disney Renaissance, I think the single most overwhelming parental fact was the absence of the mothers.
Yeah, that's true. Belle has no mother. Ariel has no mother. But I was noticing before the break that is a theme in the Gospels. You've got the young upstart Christian movement that is persecuted by its elders. I mean, it's the elders who put Jesus to death. And so there is that phenomenon, but sort of kneaded into that and really inextricable from that, particularly in the American psyche, of course, is that we are a people who are born of revolution. We rebelled against our elders. That's how this country started. And that theme of the plucky rebel alliance, you know, against, the evil empire, is something that is near and dear to the American heart. We really want to believe in the upstart underdog who does see things that the elders who are stuck in their ways don't get. And what we really want and how it how that works out in a comedy, which is what, you know, Moana and most Disney films work out to be, is they have happy endings. Well, how does the happy ending then play out? Well, it plays out with the elders seeing the wisdom of the child, the reconciliation happens by the elder capitulating and saying,
and that's, there's something to that. But at the same time, right. I think the ascendancy of this trope is something that's really happened in the last decade or so. I would say Happy Feet, by DreamWorks is the first film to, not the first film to exemplify this trope, because you do find it in occasional earlier films. I mentioned The Little Mermaid, and The Little Mermaid is an example, although the social revolution isn't complete there. Mm-hmm. But in Happy Feet, you have a colony of penguins who all sing. And there's this whole patriarchal religion behind it. It's right. There's the elders and the spirituality of the Great Gwyn, who is clearly, you know, it's the Christian God. People even say Mother of Gwyn. And so, and when one particular penguin mumbles, he dances. He doesn't sing. He's mm-hmm. different. And his father is scandalized and embarrassed by this unpenguinly behavior. And he says, you know, he's not different. He's just a normal emperor penguin. And and people ask, you know, did something happen when he was young? You know, is there an accident with the egg? No, it was a normal gestation. What does this sound like?
Yes, there is a certain subtext to all of that, isn't there?
There is. And the movie even draws it out more explicitly. You know, Mumbles has a line where he says, "Don't ask me to change, Pa. I can't."
Right.
And there's the movie even plays around with with gay themes, not actually suggesting that Mumbles is gay because there's this penguin female that he's crazy about. Right. But he takes on a certain identity because for plot related reasons, he tries to explain to her, I'm a particular kind of guy. It's not you. It's me. I'm not up for a serious relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So the movie is clearly playing with the themes of homosexuality and with social rejection of homosexuality, which is reversed by the end of the movie as all the penguins dance to celebrate when Mumbles triumphs in the end.
Yeah.
And that theme, that subtext, appears in a number of these Junior Knows Best. You can find it in Frozen.
Right.
You can find it in Madagascar too. But I do have to say, in defense of the trope, that where a couple of years ago I would have been more inclined to focus particularly on that, on this theme, with the idea that, you know, other forms of prejudice and bigotry were, you know, they've become passé, haven't they? The last year or two have caused me to rethink this thesis.
Yeah, me too.
I am now inclined to look at these themes of communities or cultures in which blinkered attitudes are preserved and, you know, young people should rebel against this. I'm inclined to see this theme in a broader light.
Yeah. It's hard to argue with that. It's certainly been an education for me, the last year. And yet the other thing that's notable, particularly if you look at this, you know, in terms of, this is a replay of a deeply American fantasy of the upstart, you know, rebel who triumphs against the oppressive elder and is truly vindicated, which the American experiment, I think it's safe to say that we've had some rather spectacular success since the American Revolution. And, you know, and we have been, in fact, reconciled with our, you know, our English elders, and the English elders have, in fact, borrowed a great deal, from us back, you know, in a certain sense, we gave the British the Beatles, just to say one example. Well, you know, what were the Beatles sure. formed by? They were formed by American rock and roll, you know?
Sure.
And that
kind of give and take, that kind of, you know, it's not like the young rebels have everything right and it's the elders who have to get their act together. That continues to play out occasionally for example, most recently in Inside Out, where you have, you know, the parents and this girl, they've moved from the country to San Francisco, and the mother's trying to keep the daughter happy and, you know, in order to help the father as he's blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and the daughter eventually has this emotional breaking point experience, and she decides mm-hmm. to run away from home. And clearly this is a big mistake, and it's something that she has to repent of. But the parents have a growth process too. They have to recognize that they can't, it's unfair to ask their daughter to be happy and cheerful all the time.
Yeah.
And as she grows up, that's not going to be the case. Sadness is going to play a bigger role in her. And that, so this kind of mutuality, each side having something to learn, like Finding Nemo is another example. You know, there are other ways of telling stories than the Junior Knows Best trope.
Right. Well, and what I was going to say was, what's remarkable about the American Revolution mm-hmm. for all of its spectacular success is how lonely it stands on the stage of world history as a successful revolution. You know, when you look at practically every other revolution that happens, you know, the French Revolution, not a huge success in a lot of ways. You know, I mean, you know, France, yeah, eventually makes a go of it, but man, what an ocean of blood is shed. And, you know, the Russian Revolution, even more catastrophically disastrous. And by the way, it should be noted that the Third Reich was a revolution. It regarded itself as such.
Mm-hmm.
and used all the language that revolutionaries used to talk about, you know, the courage of our cause. Listen to Hitler's speeches at Nuremberg rallies. This is a revolutionary in triumph, talking about how he has overcome all the oppressive forces that stood against him in his climb to making Germany great again, if you do borrow an expression. And, Chinese Revolution, same thing. And so what's really remarkable about the American Revolution is its success, because it's not a guaranteed thing. And I would love to see some kind of story where that is actually taken seriously. But of course, then you would have to write a tragedy, and Disney doesn't do tragedies.
Well, or you could have the rebels repent, which is something, you know, Pixar has worked this theme of protagonists who make mistakes and who repent, but they haven't done it in a father-son story or...
Yeah, yeah. Well, we will continue this discussion right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back with Deacon Stephen Gradonis right after this. Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here talking to Deacon Stephen Graydonis. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You could also text us at that number, or you can tweet us at Breadbox Media. So, you wanted to change direction a little bit in this segment, so I'm going to let you just go right ahead and talk about some of the religious themes in Moana.
So Moana takes place in a pagan polytheistic culture, and this is something that always raises – I always get questions whenever I review a movie that takes place in a non-Christian culture. People say to me, how can you approve this for Christian parents? And of course, I don't approve of Moana, but I don't condemn it either. And then other people suspect, well, okay, the real reason — I actually got this. Somebody wrote my comm box and they said, well, you can talk about the junior knows best trope, but the real reason that you didn't like Moana is because of all this gods and this paganism and so forth. And
yes. We can see your very soul.
Well, so I'd like to submit in my defense, first of all, my glowing 4-star A review of Spirited Away, which we're going to talk about in the next. But I'd also like to juxtapose two quotes by a pair of men who have meant a lot to you and a lot to me, C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton.
Yes.
As you know, Chesterton famously said paganism was the biggest thing in the world, and Christianity was bigger, and everything since then has been comparatively small.
Yeah.
And C.S. Lewis went in a less noted quote, but still a good one. He went so far as to say, first, let us make the younger generation good pagans, and afterward, let us make them Christians.
Now, I think there's a lot to that, actually.
There is. I think it bears.
And may I say that Washington State is ahead of the curve in that project. Get with the program, New Jersey.
Well,
go ahead.
By good pagans, of course, we mean people who regard the world with reverence and who venerate ancestors and parents, who honor tradition, who look to stories and rituals as sources of wisdom, who see the world as in some fundamental way enchanted or magical.
Yeah. Yes.
It's to look at it, and it's really, I mean, it's basically human religious imagination in its natural state, untouched by special revelation.
Right.
And
Chesterton says that the essence of paganism is a search.
Right.
Yeah.
And some of the places that search leads are pretty awful and dark.
Right.
And some of them are noble and admirable, even bordering on the Christian. And so I love a lot of the emphasis in Moana on heritage and tradition. And it's not as anti-tradition as my comments earlier might have made it seem. It is true that Moana rejects this one tradition of being islanders instead of being seafarers, but there's a lot of there is a strong tradition theme in the film. But Moana is really, in a way, Disney's most religious movie, certainly in years and maybe ever. It's religious on at least three different levels or three different themes. First of all, we get a creation myth, and there's Maui, and there's this nature goddess, and also a Tefiti is this maternal island spirit. And we meet Maui. Maui's voiced by Dwayne Johnson, and he's a scream. He's hilarious. He gets this great song called "You're Welcome," and the songs in this movie are written partly by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who
oh okay
yes yes
okay
Hamilton fame
yeah
and,
yeah
and, And you will hear the Hamilton influence.
Okay.
In Yerkum and in Shiny. And so when he meets Moana, he sings this song about how he takes credit for the tide, the sun, the sky, for wind and fire and coconuts. And he very grandiosely tells Moana that there's no need to thank him. There's no need to pray. It's okay. You're welcome. Uh-huh. And it turns out, though, that he's got these ulterior motives and that he's really in the process of scamming her out of something that he needs.
Okay.
And later in the film, not to spoil it, but the movie kind of takes him down a peg from his claimed demigod status.
Okay. Which often happens, of course, in pagan myths.
Sure.
You know, the god, especially, I mean, look at the Greek myths. You know, the gods are super powerful, but that certainly doesn't keep them from being petty little jerks. You know?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So all of this already is just screaming with, you know, religious questions and, you know, is this a critique of religion in general? Is it a kind of satire of paganism? How do we as Christians take this? But then the movie goes on to these other dimensions as well. The ocean, like I mentioned in the earlier segment, the ocean is this divine force, and it clearly chooses Moana, and it's acting on her behalf in a way that is unambiguous.
Uh-huh. All right.
But it's so unambiguous that it almost threatens to take some of the drama out of the story, because, you know, the ocean can really just save Moana anytime it wants to.
The fix is in.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
But the movie does an interesting move here. You know, usually when we attack the problem of theodicy as heirs of 2,000 years of Christian tradition and, you know, thousands of years of Judaism, we tend to take the goodness of God and the wisdom of God for granted. And the way that heretics like, what's the name of the rabbi who wrote Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? What's his name?
Kushner? Is it Kushner?
Yes.
Harold Kushner.
Harold Kushner. It seems to me that his solution amounts to God has the will to help us, but not the power. He just somehow or other, he can't do it.
Right.
Moana takes another approach. The ocean has the power. The question is the ocean really good and wise? And Maui kind of poo-poos the ocean. He says, the ocean is crazy. Just because the ocean chose you, that means that it's actually going to work out. You know, it's like following a blind prophet, only in this case, you're following a crazy god. And I thought that was a really interesting idea.
Hmm. Okay. Well, and again, you know, you certainly run into that in paganism.
Yes. Yes. Although it leads Moana to a crisis of faith, which is really very interesting. And but she struggles with her faith. And in the end, she decides that she's going to believe and she's going to pursue her, mm-hmm. her calling. And, you know, spoiler, it works out.
We are, after all, talking about a comedy, you know?
Yes.
The essence of a comedy. Somebody once said the way you can tell what kind of play you're watching when you're watching Shakespeare is if somebody is crowned king at the end, it was a history play. If everybody's dead at the end, it was a tragedy. And if everybody's married at the end, it was a comedy.
that's pretty much the definition.
Yeah.
So all of these things are very interesting. For me, the movie really collapses into postmodern, not that interestingness in the very end, in the way that the movie resolves this good goddess Tefiti and this lava monster, a demon of earth and fire called Teka. Did you see Fantasia 2000?
I did indeed. I know what you're talking about.
Remember the Firebird suite at the end?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's the lava monster and there's the life-giving sprite.
Right.
They are back. I mean, okay. it's basically them.
Okay.
But where in Fantasia 2000, it's presented in a kind of dualistic way. In Moana, it's a more monistic way. So
explain.
Well, I don't want to spoil it completely.
Okay.
Let's just say that Te Fihi and Te Ka are not as opposed as it would seem. And this resolves in a way that I find doesn't work as metaphor and it doesn't work as myth. I can't make anything of it in a way that I find useful or interesting. It's just writers who have written themselves into a corner not knowing how to end the story.
Yeah. Yeah. And also writers who are neither Christian nor pagan.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so what you wind up with is, well, you know, the villain, the monster, isn't really as monstrous as she seemed to be and as she was behaving. Okay, you know, I can understand that if it's a nature spirit, but on the other hand, you know, lava and active volcanoes are at least really dangerous. You can't walk up to them like they're your friend.
Right.
And that's as much as I'm going to say about that.
Very good. Okay. Well, it sounds like it's going to be worth seeing. I'll watch something with the Rock in it anyway, so I'll probably go see it just for that reason. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gordonis, and we'll be back to talk about Spirited Away right after this. my darling Clementine, thou art lost and gone forever. Dreadful, sorry Clementine. Oh, hello. Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. And now we're switching channels completely, and we're going to talk about one of the great movies of the Miyazaki canon, Spirited Away. So what's going on?
Well, what's going on is that Spirited Away is celebrating its 15th anniversary with theatrical screenings this coming weekend.
Goody!
On Sunday, you can watch it at, I think it's playing about 400 theaters across the country around 7 p.m. in the English Disney dub. And on Monday, if you're hardcore, you can watch it in Japanese with subtitles. So check theater listings near you and decide whether you want to see it in English or Japanese with subtitles. I know which way I would go.
Okay. Now, and, I'm curious, which way would you go?
I would go Japanese.
With would subtitles. You?
I would. Okay. I would. I'm not as much a purist of preferring subtitles with the original dialogue when it comes to animation, because in animation, you know, the vocal performance is always a dub,
right?
In a sense, even if the vocal tracks are recorded first, it's a composite performance. You have the vocal artist and the animators, and they collaborate in creating a performance. And it's just a different kind of collaboration when you have someone come along and dub it in a different language.
You can really see that at work in Robin Williams' performance in Aladdin.
Sure. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, they wrote it for him, but then they just kind of let him go.
Yes.
And they very clearly, they're not only listening to him, but the animators are very clearly watching him.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Spirited Away came out, as I say, 15 years ago. And in the United States, it opened in 2002. And I saw it and I reviewed it. And it was my first Miyazaki that I had seen in its entirety. And oh, I was not ready. I knew that I had seen something amazing and mind-blowing. I also found it really troubling on a number of levels. And you can read the review that I wrote at the time. It's at Decent Films. I've archived it now, but you can still click through to it. And you can see me kind of conflictedly trying to work through my fascination. And I was, I think, a little bit overly cautious of the pagan themes in terms of how I thought my audience would respond.
Okay.
In any case, over the years, seeing it countless times and having become familiar with the whole rest of Miyazaki's work, it has become my favorite Miyazaki. It's almost tied with My Neighbor Totoro. The two of them kind of vie in my mind, but I have a number of reasons for preferring Spirited Away.
Okay.
And this despite the fact that we were talking in the last segment about, you know, viewers suspecting that I would come down on a film for pagan religious themes. You know, and hello, here's another movie with really unsympathetic parents. and it's one of my top 25 films of all time. So clearly these are not absolute rules.
I think it just demonstrates that you're crazy and inconsistent and losing your mind. That's my theory. I'm just gonna go like that. So
there's a lot going on in Spirited Away. For those listeners who may not have seen it, it tells the story of a young girl living in Japan in modern day times, who with her rather callous, clueless parents, accidentally crosses a boundary into a spirit world. And in this world, the spirits of nature, river gods, and nature gods of all kinds come together, and they come to this bathhouse, and they come there to be refreshed. And it's a scary place because the whole bathhouse is run by this evil witch named Yubaba, and everyone kind of is shaped by the culture that she brings to this place, and it's a very selfish, very dangerous place. Mm-hmm. But there is compassion in this world.
Mm-hmm.
Radish spirit. I was trying to remember what kind of root was that. the radish spirit.
Okay.
So there is grace and humanity that's built into this world, but it's hidden. It's hidden because it has to hide out of a spirit of self-protection because of the dangers of the world. And that, I think, is really the hidden key. Many of the people that Chihiro meets are nicer than they seem at first. They don't show how they really feel because they're engaged in self-protection. But you kind of watch her learn to negotiate this world and learn a little bit how the rules work. And she learns that courtesy and hard work and other virtues go a long way. And it's just full of fascinating stuff.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm really looking forward to it showing up in the theater. We're having a birthday party on Sunday, but I'm starting to think maybe we can, I don't know, combine a birthday party and a trip to see, because I'm sure it's going to be here in Seattle, because Seattle is such a film town.
Yes.
So
major market, as we say.
Yeah, a major market, as they say. So yeah, all right, fantastic. I'm just tickled pink. I didn't realize it was 15 years already.
Oh yeah, 2001. It won the best animated movie Oscar. And it richly deserved it that year or any other year. There's so many interesting themes. I mean, we talked about enchanting the world before. And mm-hmm. and I think this is really fundamentally what Spirited Away is about. It's about a girl who comes from a crassly materialistic culture. It's a mm-hmm. deracinated Japanese culture. Her father, you know, they pass by these little Shinto shrines sitting on the ground. Mm-hmm. But they don't represent anything that the parents have any connection to. The father's faith is in the four-wheel drive of his Audi and in the cash and the credit cards in his wallet.
Right.
And in the end, he only thinks with his stomach.
Right.
And so it's really a story about a girl who's growing up in this spiritually rootless culture, getting a chance to connect with something that is culturally and spiritually and imaginatively right. more real, even if it's not, you know, comforting and welcoming and everything that you would want it to be, you know. It's,
right. Well, you know, and that's, I think that is a real struggle that's going on in Japanese culture.
Sure.
And it's, of course, it's a struggle that's going on in our culture too. The interesting thing, and I've seen this before, one of the things that's real fascinating is that Japanese, I remember reading an article on this a couple of years ago. There's a real interest in, like the music of J.S. Bach,
mm-hmm.
Because of its religious themes, and that because there is, the culture is so parched for contact with something beyond video games, you know.
Right.
and it's, you know, we're kind of in reaction to our Christian roots mm-hmm. here in the West, but Japan has no Christian roots to be in reaction against.
Right. And that's why I think Miyazaki kind of easily reaches out to these animist themes, not right. as a real alternative, but at least as an imaginative alternative.
Right.
You know, Miyazaki doesn't, he's not a believer in this kind of animism.
Right.
But,
right.
And you can, you know, it's, by the same token, you can go back to Homer and Sophocles and say, did they really believe in the deities of the Greek pantheon? This is an open question among historians.
Right.
But imaginatively, I think it offers something that, you know, it's the same thing that C.S. Lewis was trying to get at in right. the Chronicles of Narnia when he put river gods and tree spirits and so forth into his world.
Right. Well, and as Chesterton says, the essence of paganism is the attempt to reach God through the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, it's always, of course, the problem with idolatry, At the end, and that's the failure of paganism, is that paganism seeks the creature instead of the creator. And when it ceases to do that, as Chesterton said, it's important to remember that the last thing that the pagans did was ask for baptism. and that's where paganism, if it follows its nose aright, sooner or later comes to God himself. And part of what paganism is intuiting is sacramentality. The mistake that it makes, of course, is it recognizes that there's something sacred about creation, but then it makes the cardinal mistake of mistaking the creature for the creator, rather than apprehending, as sacramental Christianity does, that the creature is a sacrament of the creator, a sign through whom the creator shows himself to us. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. My co-host today was Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Our producer was Danny Head. And we will be back on Monday with Sherry Antonetti. Until then, have a glorious weekend. Bye-bye.